Hello and welcome to the Aldi podcast. I'm Ferdy Rouse, the Aldi's digital editor. Today I'll be talking to Ed West, the son of Mary Kenny, the Aldi's Postcards from the Edge columnist. Also, he's the deputy editor of Unheard and the author of Small Men on the Wrong Side of History, The Decline, Fall and Unlikely Return of Conservatism. So Ed, welcome to the podcast.
Thank you.
So, why did you write the book?
Well, it started a while back as a sort of, in a way, almost a form of therapy, understanding why I was more conservative than most of my peer group, who were sort of the standard middle-class Londoners off to university and had sort of vaguely centre-left-ish views. And I never really went through that, you know, liberal, young, progressive, radical stage. And I thought it was kind of interesting. And then I started making notes. And as I got older, I realised that something actually was changing, and my peer group and most people around me, I knew my age, weren't becoming more right-wing as they would have once, and maybe even 20, 30 years ago. After about the age of 30, they would have been a huge shift to the Conservative Party, conservative ideas, and that really wasn't happening. And I suppose I started really writing it after the election, and I realised, the 2017 election, then I realised that conservatism was really kind of repulsive to anyone under a certain age, under maybe 45, 50.
So where did you get your conservative streak from?
Well, obviously, as you mentioned, my mother is a conservative journalist. And my dad was, he features quite a lot in the book, because I tried to make the book quite memoirish, because a lot of politics books I find a bit boring these days. I find the subject sort of drags. And so I wanted to add a personal bit of colour. And my dad was a very reactionary kind of person. Mm. He was almost comically reactionary. So when we were growing up, I didn't know what of his opinions was a joke and what was actually serious. So he'd say he didn't believe in the Great Reform Act, it was a terrible mistake. He used to cite John Knox, like terribly misogynistic things, to his like female friends who were around for lunch, and they didn't really know if it was a joke or not. And he said, you know, the 14th century, everything's been downhill since then, modernity's a terrible mistake. But he started off as a communist, as a young man, idealist, and like a normal young person who wants to change the world and, you know, make everything more, you know, radical and egalitarian. But sort of, as life as a foreign correspondent sort of beat that out of him. So I think I must have got it from him. But then I go through the book and say, what is it that causes us to be conservative and what causes us to be progressive? And there's a mixture of upbringing and there's a mixture, and there is actually some genes involved. And it's also a reaction to the society we live in. So I think in my case, maybe it was growing up in the 80s and 90s, that particular, maybe that way. But it sort of depends on different people. But I think the general trend since then has been society is becoming much more progressive, socially liberal, and conservatives are really losing. So even though, you know, it gets to the point, okay, the election last year was not great. I thought, oh, that's a good thing overall. I'm glad Jeremy Corbyn's the Prime Minister. But this makes my book sound a bit strange, because how come, if conservatives are winning elections, you know, what's your point about conservatives? Well, my point is that conservatives
are good at small C versus large.
Yeah, so like the Conservative Party is very good at adapting, but in the long run, still, its support now is very concentrated amongst older people, and they have a huge problem amongst young. And this is actually quite a new thing. The Conservatives used to do quite well amongst young. They came top in 1979 and 1983, and even fairly recently they did okay amongst young people, but now they are just doing appallingly, and not just like very young people, but people in their 30s are just not attracted to conservatism as an idea. So I guess that's my overall arching theme.
No, sure. Forgive the slight jibe in this, but
that's fine.
What's it like being the only conservative dad in North London?
Well, there is one other one, actually, I realised, amongst our friendship circle. It took about 3 years of like coded talk before I realised it was actually another one of us. But, you know, I live in a very Remain-y, you know, soft left area where everyone, you know, watches Scandinavian box sets and stuff. And those areas are, you know, they're very nice places to live. I mean, this is the contradiction, really, is that people who, on the one hand, we might think of as progressive sort of global worldview, actually are making very good neighbours. They're very high-trusting people. Liberalism is a high-trust philosophy. My thing is that I think it's sometimes too trusting and sometimes leads to naivety, because it's very concerned with appearing good over appearing of doing what I think is actually the correct thing, which is, I think, what the conservatism is about.
So is it sort of like a case of theory versus practice, in a way?
Yeah, and I go through the history of conservatism, and it's always, you know, liberal ideas have always appeared good in theory, because who isn't in favour of equality, who isn't in favour of being a citizen of the world? They're all great ideas. But the history of liberalism is, since the French Revolution, has been a history of, you know, ideas that have been put into practice and turned out to be pretty bad.
So you seem to keep some particularly vicious comments for Rousseau.
Oh yeah, I think he's probably the worst person in history. But I was influenced by, you know, Paul Johnson on that. He definitely poisoned my mind against Rousseau. But I mean, everything I read about him, the guy is bad. And I kind of take, I mean, I suppose I take personal umbrage with him, because his ideas were quite influential when I was growing up, especially the education sector, the idea that, we know, we're all inherently good. And I've just seen this personally from so many people, you know, the kind of like the male feminist type who goes about, you know, why can't we all just be, you know, nice and virtuous? And they're the kind of people who are just so appalling in real life, in their own behaviour, and it just comes over and over again. And Rousseau was like the prototype of that kind of man.
But something you make very, very clear to make a point of, especially with the whole moral grandstanding in that sense, you make it very clear that liberals have won the moral battle. I mean, liberalism, even amongst conservatives, is considered to be not necessarily nasty, but certainly considered less compassionate than liberalism.
Yeah, yeah, sure, of course. I mean, there's the argument that liberals are Father Christmas and we're Scrooge. I mean, we are always presented as a bad guy. I mean, and sometimes, unfortunately, we do sort of almost take that role. I mean, the example is obviously the prime example is Donald Trump. He sort of revels in this idea of the kind of caricature bad guy. He's moronic, he's bigoted. You know, even today he was completely just downplaying all the sort of medical advice on a potentially very dangerous disease. And he's what a lot of liberals think of when they think of conservatives, you know, kind of a kind of brainless, reactive bigotry.
There's an authoritarian streak,
and just sort of reverting to base instincts, anti-science, you know, anti-rational, and there is that aspect to it. There are sort of dark sides to all political philosophies, but you know, it doesn't help that our ideas are sort of harder to sell. There is a problem that conservatism seems inherently ungenerous, because it's a philosophy of caution. And it's a philosophy that is in some way less trusting than liberalism. It's sort of less inherently, oh, you know, humans are good, so let's just, you know, rely on that. But conservatives have the basic principle of, you know, original sin, which is that all humans are not bad, but they are imperfect. And if you have a system which can be exploited, then a small number of people will do so, and that will ruin the system. So that comes down to, you know, the old theological arguments between Augustine and Pelagius, and that's been sort of the central conservative liberal split. So it's easy since Augustine to portray conservatives as like the bad guys who believe that humans are all, you know, wicked people.
Yeah, it's need to be viciously repressed.
And obviously, you know, more authoritarian end of conservatism, there is, you know, that brutal idea. But you know, I would say we are just more realistic about human nature, that it is imperfect, and it's not compassionate to build a system based on humans being nice. It's just irresponsible, because people are going to be exploited and take advantage of it.
How did, because you raise Hobbes as well, also throughout you sort of have quite an interesting sort of binary approach.
Yeah.
How does Hobbes advance on that kind of idea from Augustine? Because he's still very much in a way sort of has a secularized state, but still a fundamentally very authoritative approach.
Yeah, I mean, Hobbes is very, I like him a lot, because he's just a very downbeat, paranoid person, and he ends up upsetting everyone, which is always like a good sign. So both the royalists and the parliamentarians were out to get him at some point. He said, like, my mother gave birth to twins, myself, and fear. His basic point was that human beings need a strong authority, because otherwise it will descend into sort of vicious violence. And I think, you know, in fairness to him, so for example, recent studies, much more recent than Hobbes' day, of hunter-gatherer societies, and this is no way justifying what's happened to those societies, but they have very, very high homicide rates. You know, there is no hunter-gatherer society available where males have a homicide rate lower than something like 10%. It's always in that range, 50 to 10%. So without strong states, humans, especially men, will viciously attack each other. So there needs to be someone strong in charge.
Another one of Rousseau's points, the noble savage.
Yeah, so that's, yeah. So Rousseau's the opposite is, you know, man is born free, but everyone's in chains. And that's just, like, obviously untrue. But it's, like, a really attractive idea if you're a sort of, you know, a long, long-haired young guy who wants to attract women. I mean, which Rousseau is this kind of archetype of. But yeah, so Hobbes has the other sort of less optimistic. Now, obviously, that's not like a very attractive message to.
Yeah, because also, I mean, there's something that, I mean, I suppose you can't really avoid in that is that you to have that kind of authority, you need institutions.
Right. So yeah. So conservatism is, it comes down to it, it's about institutions. So it's about providing the justification for institutions, and particularly about conserving them, because conservatives believe that institutions are generally under threat from innovators, radicals, people who want to start from scratch, which was the sort of the revolutionary idea from the French Revolution onwards, the 20th century. So, you know, conservatives' basic idea about institutions is, okay, before we get rid of it, the fact is it stood the test of time, it's still here, and that itself provides proof that it's doing something right.
Justin's fence, really.
Yes, yeah, Justin's fence. So it's a classic example. Although I don't actually mention that. Although I should, no, probably should have. But you know, monarchy doesn't make sense. Well, we've got a monarchy. It's a ridiculous idea. But you know, we've had a monarchy now for over 1,000 years. It seems to do pretty well. There must be a reason for it. So before you overturn like something like that, you need to prove. The onus is on this person proving that what they come up with will be better effective. And there's also. The fact that, you know, institutions obviously originate with barbarism. The monarchy arose from basically powerful warlords, but time itself has given them legitimacy, the fact that they're still there. So you can sanctify them to a certain extent, maybe giving them even a sort of mythical origin.
This kind of Burke's point about sort of, yes, the majesty and ceremony.
Right,
and
yeah. So Burke's, it was almost like a show business-y idea of what the monarchy represents. Yeah, so we say, even though most people probably wouldn't say that, you know, there is literally a God-given connection between when the monarch is anointed in the coronation ceremony. We sort of have this collective, like, maybe fiction amongst ourselves, and that gives the institution authority, because these institutions provide the sort of the safety and the security and the continuity for the sort of community at large, and that's, for conservatives, is like the core of their philosophies. Mm-hmm. But there's, you know, things like, I suppose, originally it was the church, the monarchy. I think more recently it's probably family. So there's been debate over family. Conservatives think family is a great protector of the weak, and it's you know, if anything undermines it, there's going to be sort of terrible social consequences.
But more broadly, when you talk about institutions, you make a point of saying that they're quite some institutions, when they're sort of, I hate to use this word, but I can't think of another one. Infiltrated.
Yeah, right, okay.
So, you give the impression that some institutions have been completely taken over by, in a way which they're sort of anti themselves, in a sense. I mean, how do they deal with that? That gets quite.
There is a thing, I mean, it's often called Conquest Second Law, although it's actually, we're not entirely sure Robert Conquest made it, which is that all institutions, if not specifically right wing, will become more left wing. And, this is originally about the Church of England and Amnesty International, which are two great examples. The Church of England's hierarchy and most of the priests going into it are very much on the left, even though the people going sitting on the pews are much more conservative than the population as a whole. Amnesty International started off by basically two Catholics and a Quaker, and it was sort of only supported non-violent prisoners, and now it sort of tweets about transgender rights and abortion. So there just seems to be, I agree, I didn't. Yeah, infiltrate would be too strong a word. There seems to be a sort of natural institutional shift to the left once a organization develops. I mean, part of that is that they specifically become more state-funded. So the more state-funded an institution becomes, the more naturally they take a state-oriented view about things, which is inevitable, and therefore they become more left of centre. And, you know, the big charities, I mean, pretty much all the big charities in Britain take a huge amount of funding from the state. So when there's ever any cuts to government spending, whether rightly or wrongly, these charities appear on the radio saying, oh, this thing is going to have terrible effects and thing, and the state-run radio. This is one of the things that used to really annoy me. You know, the state-run radio would never point out, by the way, this guy works for an organization funded by the state, so he's, you know, he's not a disinterested party. But partly, I think, just once, kind of almost like a social setting, once there are a certain number of progressives in an organization, conservatives slightly either leave or just become quieter, or... And then probably is some sort of amount of discrimination in the jobs market on this. I mean, I think...
Oh, really? You think so?
Yeah, there's loads of evidence of discrimination on political grounds. I mean, that's found strongly in academia. Both sides will do it. Republicans in America know no better than Democrats. But there's something in some areas, something almost like a third of people have admitted to basically overlooking someone because they don't like their politics, which is almost understandable, because if you have a sort of... like a well-view in a sort of setup in an office, you don't want someone with vastly different opinions coming in. So yeah, but that does happen, and that's happened to most institutions, I'd say. I mean, even the military is... I hate to use the word woke, because I think it's just such a done-to-death word. But, you know, I've got friends in the military, and they say they're just, like, endless, like, quality and diversity classes, and they're all, you know, this is the... prestige religion they're being taught, this is what it's about. I mean, this is the military, it's literally about killing people. I mean, it's not there for transgender rights.
I must say, we've spoken without really sort of addressing liberalism quite directly.
Yeah.
What is it that you object to most in it?
I just think it's wrong. Well, no, I try to... I mean, there are different...
Is it just the sort of the fundamental optimism of it, which means that, you know, intent becomes greater than result, or...
I think that, I mean, I tried to, I don't know, I hope I can differentiate between different shades. There are different, I mean, there are people I know who are on the left who would have vastly huge differences between each other. I think what my main problem is with the most powerful sector of the left, the progressive left, is it has a basic religious function. Mm-hmm. And this it shares with other elements of the left, the most extreme obviously being communism. It has a sacramental idea. It believes that it is right and it is moving towards... The world is moving towards its direction, and it is a political community, and people who believe in it are part of a sort of religious political community. And it has this sort of inherent intolerance, I think. And with that intolerance, a sort of sanctimony, and I sort of go into this. This is a reminder. You know, when I was a kid and I went to church, I couldn't stand it because all the people were so... sanctimonious, and they're all competing to see how holy they were and, you know, how miserable they could look in this church. And that kind of sense of sanctimony and certainty, I've always seen more on people on the left, and I haven't seen it. I mean, maybe if we lived in an inherently conservative society, it might be more amongst conservatives. Maybe it's just about whoever's more in control. But I think that is a thing that people... that is a very much a progressive left idea, and that I really... That kind of zealotry I really dislike and fear.
I mean, it's very interesting to see, how you explain how it's all rooted in basically a Reformation almost.
Right. I mean, I think all politics is religion. I'm not the first person to say that.
No,
clever
all,
people
but,
think. And I think, I don't know if this is being done, but I would be amazed if the parts of our brain that in religious people triggered by blasphemy are not the same parts of the brain that are triggered by secular people, by... political ideas they hate. You know, the current thing is sort of transgender rights, and people are getting this sort of huge civil war on the left and amongst feminists about this issue, and it gets people so worked up and so angry and hateful towards people, and that is a kind of religious tribal instinct that is just straight from the Reformation, or, you know, modern day terrorism as well. So it's a very similar thing.
Mm-hmm. Is there any hope?
I'm not, by the way, comparing transgender rights to ISIS. I'm just saying it's the same. It's the same kind of religious, political feel, you know.
Is there any hope for conservatism?
I don't know. I'm not very...
Because, I mean, you, the end of your, sort of the end of the subtitle of your book is The Unlikely Return of Conservatism.
Right, so I think it will... I mean, there will always be... Because politics is polar, so there's... if there's a left in control, there'll be an opposition to it. I mean, I think it's partly will evolve into more of a populist... identity-based movement, and that would be
Isn't
the opposition.
Isn't that quite fundamentally dangerous? Is it?
Yeah, I think it is. I think overall it's bad, and I think Trump is a sort of, obviously, a symptom of that. and populists on the continent as well. Maybe Britain will be the least affected. Although I sort of wrote this in the sort of during the whole Brexit crisis, which I suppose influenced the pessimism because I had that kind of division. I found a bit quite depressing, endlessly depressing. And I just wondered if this is going to be, you know, what it's going to be like forever. But
I think we all.
Yeah.
It does kind of seem that your sort of concluding remarks are to say that, you know what, just basically give up being political, just stop paying attention to politics, and just, you know, we'll live a happy life if you do.
Yeah, I think that's probably quite good advice. You know, I think people.
Isn't that giving in?
Yeah, it may be, but I think too many people, you know, I came to realise that too many people just, and this is not everyone in the country, this is relatively a small sector, but a lot of people have lost what really matters, and they've sort of undermined their own humanity by caring too much about policies. And I worry we are, you know, copying or sort of imitating the American trend, which has been towards increase of political sectarian division, and the Republicans and Democrats now in every survey just really, really hate each other. And seem to be going up a little bit since the referendum. I don't know how it is since, if it's calmed down, but I don't think those divisions are really going to completely go away.
But you raised a few times in the book, actually, about how American politics has been mapped onto Britain in many ways.
Yeah.
What do you think about that generally? It seems to be sort of, we don't have this, I mean, we didn't have the same issues, but it's certainly pitched in the same way. What's the risk of that?
Well, I didn't think it was going to be the same before 2016, just because we're a different, you know, we're not, for example, theirs is a lot to do with rural-urban divide. That's their biggest divide at the moment. It's even more than sort of the issues of race and such and such. But since the Brexit thing, there's definitely been an increase in, for example, like people who identify as Remainers and Brexiteers much more than they identified as Tory Labour. They are so much more hostility to the other side. And those identities seem to really just sort of sprung up. I think there are some very like key similarities. And the main one is what's called the Great Realignment is we saw, I mean, someone could have predicted what happened in the election, all those seats turning Tory. That's what happened in the States in the, from the 60s onwards. And it, or, you know, if you meet now a working class white American, especially a man, you can predict pretty strongly he would vote for the Republican Party, where 100 years ago you could predict almost certainly he'd vote the other way. And there's been a sort of shift because the centre-left is sort of the elite party. And that's definitely happening in London. I mean, in Britain, where we see in London, wealthier areas now increasingly Labour, and
well, you mentioned as well that the Tories were originally considered to be the country party.
They right,
were
yeah.
The country of the people. So is this, in a way, actually sort of a...
reversion, well, yeah.
Yeah, right,
yeah, yeah. Exactly. We're much more... I mean, one of the things I think is interesting is that the sort of, you know, the industrial polars we had, which is sort of Labour versus Tories. The Labour were like overwhelmingly working class in 1945, like three quarters of voters, working class voters, vote for them. And the Tories were over middle class because you had basically a middle class and a working class with different economic interests. But maybe that was just an anomaly. And now we're going back to the pre 1850 situation, or 1900 situation, where you just had the Whigs who were like the liberal elite based in London and a few and merchants. Mm-hmm. And then you had the Tories who are, you know, a few aristos in London and basically more rural population and more conservative. And that seems to be more a template.
But that kind of seems that the Tories are now almost both. They're kind of a paradox because they have very sort of liberal economics, which
yeah.
doesn't really match up.
Yeah, well, that's the thing. I mean, I don't think there are so many contradictions in at the Conservative Party at the moment. I don't think they're going to be able to hold those two positions together. The sort of, you know, even Brexit was done like with this, there was the kind of Whiggish idea of Brexit is free trade again, international free trade. And they were very, those kind of people were very prominent amongst the leadership, but amongst the voters who voted Leave, they're very small in numbers. And so when that clashes with what probably the majority Leave voters want, which is a certain amount of protection, like cultural and economic, and, you know, to be like more like what a nation state should do, which is like be a sort of force of stability in the dangerous waters of internationalism and the global market, those two things are going to collapse. I mean, I think at some point they're going to disappoint some of the voters, whether it's the new voters up in Blyth or Don Valley, or whether it's the traditional voters. I can't see that alliance remaining forever. I mean, at the moment, they've got a bit of free pass because opposition is sort of hopeless and probably will be for at least another few years. But when that happens, they've got a problem, and they've also got their sort of demographic chickens coming home to roost.
You mentioned the sort of demography of the young people aren't sort of aging into conservatism, as it were, but you also mentioned briefly a second ago conservatism now is becoming notably more, not necessarily macho, but certainly with a more masculine.
Yeah, well, it's becoming much more. I think everything in a, the more free society becomes, the more everything becomes like dispersed, like dispersions, to use the finance term. So, you know, we're all much more into our own niches. And so even, you know, sex, gender, whatever it is one example of that. Men become, young single men tend to become much more right-wing. This is a trend, again, first in the States, while young single women become much more left-wing. So, you know, the whole, you know, Steve Bannon noticed this ages ago, so the core of, like, his support can be young, angry, like, you know, white men. In amongst young women, they are now overwhelmingly Democrat in the States, where they used to be, women used to be more conservative. In Britain, they think they voted Labour, young women voted Labour, I think like 75% of the 2017 election, but just under 70% the most recent one. They are overwhelmingly left of centre now. Well, amongst young men, especially working class men, they are going much more to the right, and that's found everywhere in Europe. So that's going to be, that's the sort of core. I mean, in Austria, I think 85% of working class men voted for the Freedom Party at the last election.
But you mentioned also in about sort of what, 6 or 7 years ago, as you said, women were much more sort of on the right, much more conservative.
Right, yeah.
I think you mentioned in the book, I'm not certain, but do you think that to religion at all? In the decline in religion, there's a kind of a liberation, there's a sort of a...
Well, the main comparison is, there is a trend, and it's always like been noticed in history, is that if any movement has a lot of young women in it, it's going to be successful. Like Christianity had, they think, from as many as 5 or 6 times as many women in some congregations as men. It was heavily female-dominated. And later, religious movements, Methodism was very female-dominated, and the evangelical movement in South America, all these movements have grown. I think Islam is basically the exception to this, but that did come about by force, so that's slightly different. And if progressivism, if it seems to be so heavily popular amongst young women, that might be a sign that its future is probably quite good, because young men tend to follow where the women are in terms of thing. Unless this is it bucks the trend, I don't know. But I mean, women within terms of religion, I don't know. The big factor determining their politics in America, particularly, is marriage and children. Like married children, married women and children vote Republican by about between 15 and 20 points more than single unmarried children. Unmarried women, unmarried children. I don't know how they vote. Yeah, so that's a big factor, because how your life goes. If you become married and have a sort of, you know, that kind of lifestyle, obviously conservatism makes much more sense. And that's another demographic factor that's against the right, because far fewer people are having kids, and they're having kids much later. And I come to it as well, the house price thing. The more expensive houses are, the more people turn to the left. And I mean, that is a big factor in the Corbyn things. Loads and loads of people in their 20s and 30s can't afford a house, a home of any sort. And obviously, what do? You're not going to be a conservative if you can't afford a home. So that will be something that the government have to...
But and yet you think. Sort of get to mention the sort of the centrist dad phenomenon, sort of the £2 million houses with Labour signs outside of them.
Right, yeah. So, I mean, centrist dads are people who should be conservatives. They should be openly... They should be carrying their blue rosettes. I mean, they are the conservative people. I say these examples, they're people who still identify as being basically, you know, Lib Dems or sort of centrist Labour people. And 20 years ago, those kind of people would be openly, definitely conservative. And I think partly it's just the lameness of conservatism, I can't even pronounce it, has pushed them out of that.
Mm. So it's also the image problem as well, doesn't really
it's the image problem, the, yeah, yeah.
All the cooler celebs.
All the cooler celebs, yeah. I mean, you know, who wouldn't want Barack Obama compared to, like, the clown they have now? I mean, it's no contest, right?
I think it was quite a fun comparison with Ted Nugent versus George Clooney. I mean,
George Clooney. I mean, yeah, he's a great guy, but you know, not one of ours, unfortunately.
Is there any sort of message of hope? I suppose it's not really in your genre, really, but any message of hope to sort of a young and or old conservative for tomorrow?
I don't know. I mean, you know, I believe I suppose I believe there are some cycles in history, so things have to come back eventually. I don't know. Mm. But there is always hope, isn't there? It's like, I don't know. Watch Lord of the Rings. That's the sort of future. We need a myth of, you know, ultimate victory to keep us going.
Potentially dangerous thought again.
On that bombshell.
On that bombshell, Ed, thank you very much for joining us on the podcast.
Thank you very much.